All right. My name is Hassan Hodges, and I am 43 years old. Today is November 25th, 2021, and I am speaking with my parents, Reggie and Celeste Hodges. So we are recording this interview in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Would you two like to introduce yourselves?
My name is Reggie Hodges. I am 77 years old. I am retired. I am a former Peace Corps volunteer, and I worked in international development for 32 years.
I'm Celeste Hodges. I'm Hassan's mom and Reggie's wife. Reggie and I met as Peace Corps volunteers in Sierra Leone. After Peace Corps, we stayed in Africa, where we both had jobs that we really enjoyed, and then we moved back to America. And I spent the last 18 years working at Duke University, mostly as a web developer.
All right. And one other person we are not who's not here with us today, but if she were, we would introduce her, is my sister, Kati. She is 4 years older than I am, but not here with us today. So Thanksgiving is always an exciting time around the family for us because it's the anniversary of when you two met. So why don't you tell me how you guys met?
We met in 1969. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Simbahoon, Sierra Leone in West Africa. I actually was going to visit a friend of mine who lived in a bungalow along the beach one weekend. And when I arrived at the house, Celeste was there, and my friend had moved to another house in town.
I wasn't at his house. I was in my own house.
She was in her own house, which had been his house previously. So that's how we initially met. You want to say something?
Yeah, the kids in Shenge, the little boys that were known as Bobos, had told me about Reggie, about Mr. Reggie, before I met him, because he was really a really cool guy to them. And we met technically at a conference before that, but Thanksgiving weekend was when we got together, and the chemistry was there. It was just magic. And from that, we gravitated towards each other immediately. In 52 years, we are still happily together.
And do you think you two would have ever met in any other situation outside of the Peace Corps in those villages?
No, we should mention that Reggie's black and I'm white. I'm a northerner, he's a southerner, and we probably would never have met if it weren't for Peace Corps.
I agree with that. I don't think we ever would have met. It's nothing in our lives that would have brought us together.
But neither of us can see how we'd ever be happily married to anybody else. So we're just really fortunate that somehow we managed to meet each other in Peace Corps.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was good.
And so you guys were in the Peace Corps, and how did that change your views of the world and how you saw things from... because of that perspective change?
I had grown up in a Catholic bubble, just around white people, all Catholic. And going overseas, it just really expanded my mind to see how other people lived and you know, how much pleasure they got out of life from doing things so differently than we did in America. And I was tolerant before I went in Peace Corps, but Peace Corps made me even more tolerant, because just seeing how other people live and how they have different lifestyles and they don't believe necessarily what Americans do. Like my next door neighbor in Sierra Leone, she told me how she was just really amazed that Reggie and I were like a monogamous couple, because she was going with her husband to buy another wife. She was the first wife. She wanted her husband to get a second wife, so that she would have someone that she could be senior wife over, and this other woman would help her cook and would help her on the farm, and she would know more nights where her husband was if there was a second wife. And after the second wife came, and that was a very successful relationship for all of them, they went out to buy a third wife. And when the third wife came, they had to return her because she burned the rice when they were cooking. So that was interesting. And the other way that Peace Corps, one way Peace Corps really changed my thinking, it has left me with a permanent sense of guilt. at how wealthy and not wealthy, but how privileged Americans are. I just think of it all the time when, like the lifestyle we have, and the food we eat, the health care that we have, and how people in other parts of the world don't have these things.
I grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina, doing the 1950s and early 60s. It was a very segregated community. All of the schools, the libraries, the buses, theaters, and everything were segregated. And I always felt like it must be a better world out there where people got along and everyone was treated as equal. And I always felt like I was in a bag. And when I got out of my high school and college experience and joined this Peace Corps, a whole new world opened up to me. I saw how other communities lived. I saw how people got along, and I saw how people were treated. In Africa, I learned to have respect. Well, I guess I always had the respect, but I learned about other people's views as they relate to religion, as they relate to family, as they relate to life in general. And this exposure, I think, changed everything in the way I view the world. And when I say everything, I'm talking about religion, I'm talking about family, I'm talking about relationships and all. So my view of the world changed a lot as a result of my Peace Corps experience.
All right, and a lot of other people that have gone through the Peace Corps, they kind of went through the Peace Corps, and then after that, they just came back to America.
After those 2 years?
Yeah, they did their stints, and they're like, oh, I hear these stories, and they're kind of short. It's like a two-year span. You two seem to have stayed in Africa a bit longer after that.
Well, we were not Peace Corps for all of those years. We went over as Peace Corps volunteers, and when we decided to get married, we really hadn't made a decision on what we were going to do after Peace Corps. When our Peace Corps days came to an end, I was offered jobs and positions relating to Peace Corps because basically I had done a good job as Peace Corps volunteer, and I became a coordinator for Peace Corps in the region. I went on to become an associate director and even a director for a while before going into international work with other nonprofits. I found it a lot easier to live in Africa. I think being in a interracial relationship has something to do with it, because we were not seen as anything different there, and I liked the way we were treated there, and we knew that if we came back to America, we'd be looked at as in another way. You have to consider, too, what was happening in those days. In 1967, the Loving versus Virginia Supreme Court decision made interracial marriages legal, and we were together as a couple only 2 years after that decision. Living in Africa, we didn't have to worry about any of that, but coming back to America, we thought there would be things we would have to face.
Yeah, it's like because interracial couples couldn't be married in a lot of places in America. It was, I think from the moment we met, we met, and the weekend we met, we were together with a bunch of other Peace Corps volunteers. We went down to watch the moon rise after Thanksgiving dinner. That was our entertainment. We watched the moon rise, and the other people gradually went back up to the houses. And Reggie and I stayed out in the jetty for a long time. I think that evening we knew that, without really knowing that we were going to be together forever, we knew that we were just meant to be. And no matter what the laws in America said, or what my family said, or anybody said, we were together, and we were going to be together forever. And if America didn't want us, we would go somewhere else. Oh, and the other thing about staying in Africa is that we were happy there. We both had jobs that we liked, and we enjoyed. I mean, there were a lot of challenges with living in West Africa, but we liked it. And we got to a point when our kids were like 7 and 11, where they were growing up without seeing much of their grandparents or their cousins. And so we wanted to move back, you know, so they could see their family. And I also wanted to be able to go to grad school and be doing something more professional than I was doing there. So we ended up coming back to the States, but we were really happy in Africa.
I always felt like I was doing something that was meaningful, it was challenging, and it was exciting. And as I communicated with my brothers and sisters and friends I'd gone to school with, most of them had become teachers or had gone into jobs, and it was like they were cogs in a machine just rolling along. And I felt like when I was working on specific projects, if they related to building schools or working with agriculture or construction, that they were projects that were making a meaningful difference in people's lives in Africa. And there was a certain kind of reward or feeling you get from doing something and seeing that results.
So along these lines of you guys being together, you have kids. One of the things that I always ran into as a kid, where we were in an expat community and had these American friends who had parents who had somewhat similar stories, somewhat different, some involvement with the government that had brought them overseas, whether it was State Department, USAID, other
Peace
things.
Corps, yeah.
Yeah. Talking to everybody else, they'd always been born in America.
Yeah, that's
so
true,
And remember other kids' parents who, like when they were having other siblings, they would go back to America and the kids would be born there.
Yeah.
But tell me about my birth and why why you stayed in Africa for my birth.
Yeah. Well, because if we had gone the route of going back to America for me to give birth to you, I'd have to leave like 2 months before, like when I was 7 months pregnant, to fly home. And I wasn't going to leave Reggie for 2 months. We were going to be together through everything in life, including childbirth. And looking back, maybe it wasn't a good idea. But we do have other American friends whose children were born in Africa, and they are doing really well. The ones that we know. So yeah, it was a little crazy. Like 9 months of vomiting and a day of hemorrhaging, but it all worked out.
I can tell you the government-related doctors who were in the embassies and in Peace Corps advised us against having children in Africa. And we did not accept the advice. We wanted to have children in Africa, and we thought it would be safe. And we even went beyond what people had told us about the best hospitals in the country. We decided to have our children in a village called Sarabu. Sarabu was about 55 miles from Bo, down a little dirt road, and there were three nuns who ran this hospital.
Irish nuns.
And this is where both of our children were born. And as for your specific birth, Celeste can tell you about all the pain and suffering and everything, but the two things that stand out for me is that you were born during the rainy season when the roads are terrible, and to get to the hospital was a real challenge. We had to go through a strip of mud where people in the village had to put sticks out so the car wouldn't get stuck going through the mud. And then after you were born, I remember we had been warned against the possibility of complications, and Celeste started to hemorrhage after your birth. And I think after about 45 minutes, the doctor said she would clean me up so she could hook us up, and my blood would be able to pump through both. She did not have to do that because the bleeding stopped after
because
about 45 minutes.
No, I had to lay perfectly still. I didn't move. I hardly breathed for the next 6 hours.
Well,
the bleeding stopped.
When I told an American doctor that, they said that hooking people up and pumping blood directly from one person to another had not been done since the 1700s. And,
But then when we came back to the States, and I went to grad school, got a degree in library science, and worked as a medical librarian for 9 years, hearing about all the complications of childbirth, even in America, and knowing doctors whose wives had horrible experiences in childbirth. You know, I might never have wanted a baby at all if I had known.
The end results is the children that you get, and we got two excellent children out of our experiences, and we knew so many parents who had had challenges with their children, both medical and raising the children.
Even in America.
So yeah. We feel very fortunate. Both of you all had no major problems, and you came out well, and we survived, and we're glad we did it, because there's a personal feeling about being in the delivery room and being together, even though you're in a village, and we had to go outside of the country to buy little things like a baby bed and stuff and special mosquito nets, and it was a challenge, but it was nice. It was our life then.
It was just our life, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And many years later, when my daughter was born, we had the choice of, well, do we use a hospital or do we do a home birth? And that was a very quick conversation. It was hospital. Like, when you have these resources available,
yeah,
you can use them.
Right.
So I was born, worked out okay medically, a little touch and go there, but it worked out okay. Was there any paperwork after that to get things smoothly put together? Perhaps a birth certificate, everything go smoothly there?
Yeah, the birth certificate and marriage certificate. We have the local documents, but we have a lot of connections at the U.S. Embassy, and it was totally legal that we took the local certificates to the embassy and got American documents. So we have like State Department certificates of birth for the kids and the State Department witness of our marriage. And so it's all totally legit in America now.
In the place where you were actually born, they do not give out birth certificates in Sarabu, but there was a seat in the district capital in Bumpe where you could go get it. And if you couldn't get it there, you could get it at the larger capital. So we went through several steps trying to get the birth certificates, and I think after a month or so, we did wind up with a legal Sierra Leone birth certificate with the correct name and date and everything on it. But when we arrived at the airport, the first time you were leaving the country, they wanted to know, where was your visa?
Where was your visa to be in Sierra Leone?
And you had no visa in your passport, because we had just gotten your passport, and you were born there. So the people at the airport didn't know what to do. They had not seen that situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you lived in Sierra Leone for a few more years and then moved to Liberia.
Yeah.
And we already know from the medical side that you did not always follow advice from the government. Anything interesting happen while you were in Liberia?
We do believe in COVID vaccinations. We are fully vaccinated. We believe in the government. We believe in vaccines.
When you look at the movement, we actually moved from Sierra Leone to Ghana. Then we moved from Ghana back to Sierra Leone. And then from Sierra Leone there, we moved to Liberia. But during this time, I was working on different development projects. We moved to Liberia in December of 1979. It was a very tense time in Liberia. It was just after they had hosted the OAU. And about 4 months later, there was a bloody coup.
April 12th, 1980.
The government was overthrown. The president was killed. All the government officials were arrested. They were tied to telegram poles and executed. And the U.S. government brought in the military to evacuate American citizens out, and you were a child then, and we signed papers with the government, United States government, saying that we would not be evacuated. We didn't want to be evacuated because we felt that Liberia needed assistance more at this time than ever before, and we stayed in Liberia even after the coup and with all of the civil disturbance and fighting going on.
But we also had tickets. I mean, since we work for an American organization, if we did need to evacuate, as long as we could get to the airport, we could have gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
And staying there, I was, because Reggie was with a a nonprofit that wasn't U.S. It wasn't U.S. government agency. It was a nonprofit funded by USAID. But because of that, I was not. I couldn't get the jobs that were available to embassy wives and USAID wives. But when they all left, when they all evacuated, they were looking for people. So they hired me at the embassy, combination embassy and USAID, for the summer after the coup. And that turned into a full-time job with USAID, which I never would have gotten if we hadn't stayed. And on that job, computers were just being introduced, and I went for computer training at AID. And it turned out to be, you know, just a really good decision for that we stayed there. And we had no problem with, you know, because of the coup or the problems in Liberia.
I worked to set up two vocational schools, a large vocational school in the capital city, Monrovia, to train people in carpentry, masonry, electricity, air conditioning, regular subjects. It was the largest school of its type in West Africa immediately when it was finished. And then we did another school, which was a rural development, agriculture, animal husbandry school, about 200 miles from Monrovia in a very rural area called Foya. And this is what I spent the next 5 years doing. And the country remained unstable through that entire period. But the schools helped the country to get back on the right direction for a while. And it also gave me an opportunity to meet a lot of people who were both sound leaders and also people who turned out to be warlords and other things. So I had interactions with both.
And we didn't protect our kids from, keep them from seeing the things in Liberia. Some parents didn't want their kids to see anything that had happened, but there were dead bodies in the streets. There were car wrecks from soldiers who had never driven before, stealing cars, trying to drive. So that kind of stuff was messy. But we went out and we saw the reality of a coup, and we were with the kids, so we could all see it. And I hope you weren't traumatized.
Oh, just a little bit of therapy to fix it, not too much, but yeah, it's in there. Safety and security is kind of a weird thing, but it was kind of that weird space of like all these things that were so exciting as a kid, where it's like, oh yes, we had a 6-foot cinder block fence that was topped with broken glass, and there were, you know, dogs inside to protect everything.
And the American school was closed. Everything closed down after the coup. We stayed inside of our compound for 2 or 3 weeks. And then at one point, the American embassy gave the all clear for Americans to go out again and for the American school to open. So I picked you and Kati up after school one day, and we went to the embassy compound to swim. And while we were at the swimming pool, we could hear gunshots. And so we left the pool. Because that was the day that they were executing the government officials on the beach. And I only knew one way home because we hadn't lived there very long. And that was the trying to drive through the crowd that was going to the executions was the one and only time I was truly afraid in Africa. And it wasn't because people were trying to hurt us, but it was these massive throngs of people who are on drugs or drunk, and they were just swirling and dancing and trying to get over to the executions, and I was trying to get home safely, and we made it.
Yeah, we made it. So how did living in Africa prepare you for living in America?
You can go first.
You can go first.
And do you have any reverse culture shock?
I always had new jobs lined up when a specific job ended. And it was because I was offered these jobs. I was not running around looking for them. And I used to look at them and see which ones were the best. By 85, you and Kati were of an age that you needed better schools. And we thought it would be good to take a job in the United States. So I took a job in the United States, where I still was responsible for work in Africa and had to travel back and forth. And we brought the two of you to America. We bought a home here. Celeste was able to go to school and get her master's degree, while you all went to regular school. And I still spend half of my time working in Africa and half working in Philadelphia.
There was reverse cultural shock. In different time, different situations in Africa, like in Sierra Leone, no matter what happened to you, somebody was going to help you. In Liberia, it was different. People could even, they could be pretty nasty to each other, not just to Americans. And, you know, every time we went out in the car, we knew we might be harassed and people trying to shake us down for money. And I remember the first time I went out to buy bread at the grocery store in America, just feeling so weird that I could just go out to the street, the main street, turn left, go to the grocery store, get the bread, and nobody harassing me, nobody trying to shake me down, nobody telling me that I forgot to turn my flasher on. It was a different world. And once again, we adjusted. It was, but you and Connie had more to go through with adjusting to schools in America than we did with just living.
Yeah, long pants. That?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Long pants were an adventure.
Yeah. The fall we returned to America, you were the very last child in your school to switch from short pants to long pants because you hated long pants. Because in Africa, you'd only worn short pants. Yeah.
We spent time looking for neighborhoods that had a lot of diversity in it so that they wouldn't be all white, all black neighborhoods where you all could grow up experiencing both worlds. Remember the time you came home from school and said the children were playing games there and you had to be black or white and you wanted to know what color you were. And the response was, don't play that game.
I also remember having had that bubble that we lived in Willingboro. Where it was just a predominantly black community. And that was, you know, that was our local world. And then we'd play like other schools and sports and like, yeah, there were white people there. And then I went off to college and it was like day three.
I'm Rutgers.
Yeah.
Rutgers, a big, large state school.
Yep. Yeah. It brought people from all over New Jersey. I'm like, there are so many white people here. And
kind of scary, huh?
Yeah. And you're like, this, I had not realized that before from, you know, my own sets of, you know, of bubbles that I'd lived in and you know, all the family members that we had interacted with. And I had just kind of skipped over that detail of what the composition of America was.
Yeah. So. Well, go ahead.
Of all the places we've lived, the place where race is a issue of concern is in the United States. We never lived any place else where race was a major issue. In other countries that we lived in, the tribe that you are from tended to be a larger determiner. Oh. People did not look upon two people from America, if one was black and one was white, as being anything unusual. But they did look at another tribe. And I really learned from that how people can develop prejudice toward people and people of a certain religious background and thing. And it even permeates today when you hear people talking about hating Muslims because of the jihad and the way they act. These are all learned behaviors that come about as a result of a culture. And it's not only relating to race, it even relates to religion. Everyone thinks their God is the true God. And sometimes it just bothers me to hear people, have you accepted the God into your life?
Have you accepted the real God?
And you go live in another country and they think they have the true God and the only God. And you just wonder, are those gods up there fighting? Are there 15 different heavens up there? And do the gods get along? You know, so it is strange to hear that. It makes you realize, too, how much things are based on the culture that you come from. People in America are predominantly Christian because their parents were Christian. Yeah. And you go to a country and you live in a community where they are predominantly Muslim, they're Muslim because their parents were Muslim. And I realized that from the village that I lived in. I went there as a Christian and it was predominantly Muslim. I worked with Muslims and I realized how they thought and how their religion worked. And I realized there's nothing bad about it. And it's just a different way of life.
So much of life is just an accident of birth mm-hmm. that determines what your life is going to be like.
That also helped to mold our way that we think about religion, too. We learn to respect all people's religion, but not to try to impose anyone on anyone, and not to make you all believe that one religion was superior to another, and you should be this and that, and let people make their decisions based on what they think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So do you have any art in your attic?
Some of it's in museums now. Good question, Hans.
People have different beliefs and likes. I always loved art. And when I went to Africa, I felt like I was going to return one day and become a teacher. And the art would
return
to America and become a teacher. I was a trained teacher from my college background. And I thought initially by collecting little items and having them available when I came back, I could use them as visual aids in the classroom. And I started collecting little things like wooden combs and spoons and trinkets and jewelry and little pieces of art. And the collecting of traditional artifacts and art, it just grew until we had a room full of things after 10 or 12 years. And we arranged to ship all of these things back to the States, and we put them in storage. And we filled the room up again after another 5 or 6 years, and we made another shipment, and these things were in storage. And when we retired 6 or 7 years ago, we finally unpacked everything and put it out, and we had over 600 items of art and artifacts, which we have been donating to museums in North Carolina and in Michigan. We have donated a couple of hundred pieces to major museums, but we still have a lot. It's not all museum quality, but some of it will go to African-American dance troupes and to societies that have a focus on African history, and some will go to schools. We're in the process of disseminating it.
So Reggie's in charge of all the carvings. I'm doing the photographs. We took a lot of pictures in Africa, tons of pictures, just because we were so in love with the culture and, you know, just liked the pictures, liked the people. And we would take pictures of people, and then we had a dark room in our house. We would go home, develop the pictures, and then give the pictures back to the people in the villages, and that made them want more pictures. So we were able to get, just living there and getting pictures back, we were able to get pictures that other people wouldn't be able to get if they were tourists or just going in to photograph. And we were just doing this for our own pleasure and thought at some point we'd retire and put some of them up on, you know, Flickr or something. And people from Duke University, where I worked, were interested in these. And the Duke University Rubenstein Archives of African and African American culture and history. They want all of our pictures. They want the negatives, the slides, and the prints. Which for us it's just a really big honor that they want these things. So I'm in the process of digitizing everything, and which is not that's kind of the easy part. The hard part is culling all these pictures. I probably had 5,000 to start with, but that was personal pictures, pictures that are horrible, out of focus, need to be thrown away. And other good ones that are, some of them are ready to go, others need a lot of work in Photoshop. So I'm in the process of getting these ready. I have 300 ready to go now. But at some point, hopefully there will be a Reggie and Celeste Hodges collection of African photos. And based on what we've put up on the web, we've had some people contact us occasionally. They're writing theses, graduate level theses, or some teachers at Duke and UNC who want some of our photographs for their classes. So this is our whole collection is going to the archives, and hopefully somebody will be able to use it in the future. And we don't want to make any money off of it. We just want the collection to be used for good.
An example of what she is talking about, people make the cloth in Africa called country cloth, they actually have to grow the cotton, and they have to spin the cotton, and they make these long bands, and then they set up a tripod loom, and they weave the cloth, and they use natural dyes. We have these instruments that were used for doing this, and we have pictures of people producing the cloth at all levels. And these are the things that museums are interested in seeing, that process. It was an educational experience for us to learn how people, even 300 or 400 years ago, produced these things. There's still people in Africa who are doing it today, even though it's becoming a lost skill. And we have pictures and we have examples of the tools and instruments, and you put them together, it's a good research project for people to look at from a university.
Oh, we got some other really cool pictures. Mm-hmm. We have babies being force-fed, a truth-telling ceremony. You were there, Haas, where they were trying to find the thief who had taken some money, and they went out. The guy who ran this was, he put an iron rod in a fire, and you're going to think this is crazy, but when he put the rod on the arm of a person who had not stolen the money, it would feel cold, but when he got to the person who had stolen the money, it burned the person's skin. And we had heard from other Peace Corps volunteers about this type of thing and didn't know if we believed it or not. And then we went and saw this happening at a friend took it to his village, and this happened to be going on. And we don't tell many people about it because they'll think we're crazy. But we do have a picture of this. So we have that. Go ahead.
A lot of things that people try to explain and people don't believe, the truth of it comes out if you can see the image and see the materials. I've had people in construction ask me, how do people build a house in a village without any building materials? And they make their materials from what's found there in the community. Everything from the walls to the windows, the roof, and you take a picture of it and you see them building the house, all of a sudden it makes sense of how they do it. But to tell people a person can build a house with no nails, with no hinges, with no materials purchased from a hardware store, it's hard for a person to believe. But if you see it in a picture, you can see how it's done.
And the paint coming from the river?
Paint comes from from everywhere. The people in the village can live without anything coming from outside in most instances. There was a time when there were no stores, and they made all of their own soap, that they made everything they needed to live a normal life, from the cloth to the food to the medicine. And we have pictures of these things happening. We lived in traditional villages where there were no doctors and there were no stores or anything.
And there was no trash.
Mm-hmm. No trash.
Because people just used natural materials that they found to make things. Maybe some little tins from tomato paste that they bought, but the kids will use those to make toys.
So we're starting to get a little bit low on time. We've got about 6 minutes left. Is there anything differently that you would do differently in your life, or that you look back on as a regret or something in this journey that you'd want to change?
I would want to get a degree in education and know what I'm doing before I join Peace Corps to teach. I love the Peace Corps experience, love the kids, love the village life, just love everything. But I didn't know what I was doing when they took me in as a teacher. And
when I first went into Peace Corps, I had a little bit of confidence in what I was doing. I was one of the unusual Peace Corps volunteers in that I did have an educational degree. I had a background that had agriculture in it as well as construction, and people felt that sending a volunteer out trained as a teacher or construction or, you know, a skill would make sense, and that I had those skills. But I learned so much more from the work I did that it didn't even compare with what I knew when I got there. I'd say my education was at a level of 15 when I arrived, and it was at a level of 100 when I left, because I knew how things operated. I knew how things worked. I wouldn't have done anything different about that. But one thing, expectations have a lot to do with determining a person's success. And when I went overseas, I thought that work would really turn a country or a community around. And I realized it's very difficult to have major impact on a community through the type of projects that outsiders do. But there is a feeling of accomplishment in what you do when you realize you impact individuals. And I can think of hundreds and hundreds of individuals that were impacted by projects I worked on or education they received as a result of going through a school. But when I look back, I do not see a change having occurred in Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Ghana that made a major impact on that country. And I think a lot of people going overseas think they are going to have a major impact on that country. And the impact you have is on people. But eventually those people will impact the country.
Well, we got together at a reunion a couple of years ago with about 80 Peace Corps volunteers from Reggie's 1968 group. And the question came up about impact. And every single person felt that Peace Corps changed us, you know, as Americans, for the better. But when we talked about the impact we had, it was like Reggie said, it was on individuals. But the country was, you know, we didn't have that much of an impact as a group through the years on the country, but that the country had a huge impact on every one of us.
But the impact on a child like Mamadou, who went on to become a government leader or a successful businessman, or the impact on Adama, who went on to raise her children in a healthier way because she knew about diseases and things because she learned these things in school. Anyone who came in contact with Peace Corps and acquired knowledges and skills that helped them lead a better life, that was enough of a reward to make the whole experience of living and working in Africa worthwhile.
That is a powerful way to wrap this up of talking about the individual impacts, because that's the thing that anybody can do, is impact any other individual positively.
So Hans, so, in 2 minutes, tell us about the impact Africa had on you.
Oh, the impact it had on me. It really gave me a perspective of what first world problems are, where, and the joke I use about it is finish your food because we can give it to the starving kids in Africa because they were right outside. So it just gave me that perspective of like what problems inside of America and inside of a bubble look like versus problems that are outside of that bubble, and see the world as a lot of different bubbles, from the, you know, the safety and security that we had in, you know, in our compound, and like anytime that was breached, and then you have the different set of rules that apply outside coming in. And I remember one time when somebody had broken into, gotten over the fence and was trying to steal a car, and we sent our houseboy. Sent him to get the police. The police came and did nothing because they could get a bigger bribe from him than from helping us. Yeah. And it's just kind of realizing that, you know, a system of laws and order, and as bad as things may be in America, they could always be much worse. And that it's very important to maintain those systems and to keep America strong the way that it is, or tries to be. It's kind of a mixed thing there, but a place where, you know, systems are not built on corruption, because coming back to individual impacts, that all boils down to, you know, that lack of safety that one feels when the police cannot help them. So
that's what you call anarchy.
All right, so we have 45 seconds left, but I think we have reached the end. Thank you very much for doing this.
Well, gladly. Thank you for being our child and being along on the ride.
All right, take care.
Thanks. Yeah. I didn't think I'm done. I finished my only regret in life is